Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we're talking about the road to global ability. We are joined by CEO and founder of Outcrowd Group, RJ Falcioni. RJ, thank you for being here with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric and Bob.
And RJ, how are you doing today? How have you been recovering or getting back to normal now that the lockdown is over? We're starting to see some return of normalcy. How's everything treating you?
It's been an interesting run since COVID really hit. I was actually in Barcelona, Spain, and you know, was amidst the lockdown there and was lucky to get out and got back to Colorado. And like so many of other of us, so we've been in the house for a couple months now, and so you know, it's given us time to focus on business. But it's nice to get back out, on the lake and get back out to camping and things like that. It's certainly been a couple of very interesting months.
No doubt about that. And RJ, so we're talking about global ability. We're talking about how this industry is quickly shaping, to be a global industry. And yet we all have roots, everybody here on, you, Bob, myself, we all have roots in Colorado. This is kind of where it started for us here in the United States. Take us through your history a little bit and how you came to found the Outcrowd Group. Just give us a sense of all of that.
Sure. Yeah, so I grew up in Connecticut and was actually very vocal about being straight edge and drug free for most of my life until I basically turned 21 and found cannabis. So I kind of had a really interesting start where a lot of people you find in the industry started smoking when they were 12 or don't smoke at all. And I was kind of in that college sort of age smoker. And I think as they say with religion, those that come to it later in life tend to be more vocal or evangelist about it. So I think when I found it, I realized there was so much more to it than just getting stoned. I love the historical sort of tribal element of it. I went to college for history and law, so that was really appealing to me in terms of wanting to know more about it. And that really led me on a course through the last 12 years or so where, I was in law school, but I was flying back and forth between Colorado and California, working for dispensaries and vertical operations in both states while I was still in law school, knowing that, I was going to pass the bar and probably never spend one day in an office wearing a suit. But that I was really going to devote what I was learning about the approach to life that law school teaches us and put it to cannabis. So as soon as I got out of law school and the New York bar exam in July was over, about 2 weeks later, I was on the road to Colorado to get involved in a 120-light cultivation facility and a dispensary that was attached to that. And that's really where I sort of cut my teeth with somebody who'd come out from the East Coast years before and sort of laid the path for it, for being able to do bigger things like that. And I was fortunate to sort of always be in the right place at the right time with my friends here in Colorado and then the folks that I met in California who, were really the top geneticists and are still some of the most revered geneticists in the market today. Kind of just always been lucky and have been able to hold a bunch of different roles and always focus on, the medical benefits the plant brings and being able to return that to people. It's always really what I took the most passion in and I've been able to do that regardless of whether it was, here in Colorado as a cultivator or running a delivery in Oakland or now in these tech companies in the last couple of years and really looking to empower the businesses that serve customers. So it's certainly been an interesting 12 years and I owe it all to cannabis. So
I'm fascinated by your studies, history and law, and I can appreciate the fact that you didn't want to go down the road of working in an office and being a lawyer. I sincerely can. But let's talk about history for just a minute. History is one of my favorite topics of all time. And I think that people that like history love history. History is instructive. It's interesting. It's characters. You couldn't write it better fictionally than what happened in real life. And I've got two teenagers in school. They hate history. They can't stand it. And I think it's the greatest thing ever, especially at certain periods of time in our history. And, you know, what's significant and what was interesting. What is it about history to you that's interesting and attractive? Because I need to take some things back to my kids because they just don't get it.
I think a lot of it comes from being, comes from being an only child and really always looking for a different world to exist in, you know, and the idea that history is something that is completely different than what you exist in today. I mean, you take the ancient civilizations and juxtapose them against the early American history, against what's happening today. And from the technology aspect, the political aspect, the interaction of people within those times. I mean, there's so many interesting facets to it. If you like Star Wars, then you should like history. You know, it's the same kind of, I don't want to say escapism, but sort of certainly the ability to be transported to somewhere that's different than where you are now. I mean, you know, who doesn't love the movie Back to the Future, you know? So.
No, that's well said. And certainly history, to your point, repeats itself in many ways. And we're seeing that happen right now. But, when you talk about the globalization or the global ability of the cannabis industry, that's something that we focus on quite a bit. I know you do as well. So maybe comment on that, but start with this notion. I hear this response all the time. Why the heck should I care? Why should I care about the globalization of the cannabis industry? I have a dispensary in Oakland. I have a CBD business in Massachusetts. Why should I care?
If the world was only so small as your own neighborhood, you know, you might be king. I think that a lot of folks get caught in that trap of you know, regardless of which size pond you're in, you know, thinking that you're the biggest fish or that you're in the biggest pond. And, we haven't even, especially from a domestic standpoint, begun to scratch the surface of global cannabis. The fact that Colombia is exporting to the UK or to Canada, or that Germany is receiving imports and that America has nothing to do with it. I just don't understand how you can consider us to be the leading sort of developed country, if that's how you feel about it, and think that we shouldn't have a role in the global supply chain, if you will. And I think a lot of folks are probably so overwhelmed with just surviving or thriving in their one or 20 dispensary chain that they're probably not looking outside of it. And if they are, then they're probably one of the few massive companies that are out there, are one of the smaller operators that's nimble enough to be in a couple different places at one time. So, I don't see why you wouldn't care. I think it's the most important topic that you could be concerned with, especially for upstream, midstream businesses. You know, wouldn't you want to be part of that global revolution and part of that global supply chain as opposed to just selling weed in Oakland?
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly the point that we talk about. And then you talk about just the excitement of being on the ground in other places. And I know you spend a lot of time in Spain and you're deeply connected there and your businesses as it relates to the cannabis industry. And that's an exciting thing too. Yeah. And I love your Back to the Future nod, because again, who doesn't love Back to the Future? But I remember that scene in Back to the Future when Michael J. Fox puts on the silver suit and he puts on Van Halen and he puts headphones on, and he was from the future. Every time I go to Europe, and it's getting better, people talk to you and they say, well, we don't know what's going to happen next. And you say very clearly and articulately, oh, it's probably one of three things on whatever the issue is. And they look at you with these glossy eyes and they say, how would you know? You must come from the future. And in a certain sense, we do. Tell us how that has allowed you to succeed and thrive.
Yeah.
Because we do come from the future. And I'm not going to say we've seen it all, because nobody's seen it all. But you've seen enough to have a really good sense of what's next.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great lead-in. You know, I mean, Spain I think I first got to Spain maybe 3 or 4 years ago, predated by my main client there, who's an American-based company based out of California. But 2011 or 12 went there and really started to make inroads and started to figure out what the laws were and how to maneuver within the regulations and things like that. But really, you know, we like to say Spain is probably, it's probably now about 2015 or 16 California, over in Spain. So when I say that, I mean, you know, you still have vendor Tuesdays or vendors coming in without any real regulation or certainly no distribution. There's no tracking. But man, are consumers happy? Are the products amazing? Is there so much identity behind every collective or social club? You know, they're really at that sort of, I don't want to say peak purity, but sort of where, you know, you have the industry running on all cylinders. You have a bunch of really invested and interesting folks putting products out, and the money hasn't really started to dictate or corrode sort of the soul that goes along with it. So history is certainly, you know, repeating itself in Spain in that sense, where we're again seeing this really reminiscent to California pre recreational adult use legalization, but with some really stark contrasts that I really do believe will help those shops stay grounded in their identities and not repeat history, in the sense that I do not see big money really taking a hold in Barcelona for some time the way it obviously has in California.
You make a good point. And, you know, my own personal experience in Spain, I was tasked probably 3 years ago, maybe closer to two, with going out and assembling some acquisitions in Spain for a particular client. So I went and visited some clubs in Barcelona, a club in Alicante, mm-hmm. a club in Malaga, and we spent time there, and they were well run and they were well organized, and the paper, the documentation, all was in line. And then, of course, the lawyer sticks his head in and says, all right, well, we need to look at the licensing element of it. So you talked about regulations, or I would suggest the lack thereof. Give us a little sense about the regulatory process, because what I learned in that process a couple of years ago, and I know a lot more about it now, but you probably know much more, is that there's really not a whole lot of formal government approval, except maybe a letter from a local government that says, yeah, you know what, you can go ahead and do this right now until we say you can't do it any further, which of course doesn't give a buyer much comfort. Give us a little description about how that works.
Yeah, totally. So I think, you know, if you look at Barcelona specifically, you know, you mentioned some really great other locations in Malaga being down south and places like Tenerife, you know, which are sort of like the Puerto Rico, if you will, of Spain, in the sense that they're using similar laws and sort of a property, if you will. But if you look at Barcelona, you know, you've got this really interesting dichotomy between, you know, the Catalonian government and the crown in Madrid. So when they attempted to legalize and really put those regulations into to find, you know, the amount of flower that could be cultivated each year by each social club, and things of that nature, that would have really taken what you just mentioned, the it's cool until it's not cool vibe, and turned it into something that was really, you know, bankable, that you could rely on to run a business, especially from being, you know, outside of that market, if you will. When they tried to put those laws into place, you know, the crown, basically Madrid, said, you know, you can't do anything without our approval. And that's basically the thread that led to, you know, their revolution attempt a few years back, where, you know, Barcelona and Catalonia was going to leave Spain, basically as a result of the central government in Spain saying, we're not going to allow you to legalize cannabis in this, you know, again, this simple yet regulated process that would have improved what's there now. So I think that's a really interesting thing to note. And then in terms of, you know, setting up a social club or distributing or selling or growing, you know, it's really still a very gray area the way California was. You know, you have a lot of business owners, especially social clubs. And I think it's important to understand that in Barcelona and in Spain in general, the product is to be consumed within the club. So it's a major different. Like it's a 180 from the way dispensaries operate here domestically. You know, there you're expected to literally smoke the product and not leave with any of it in the club. And these places have a lot of times have full food menus, full bar menus, coffee, desserts. You can bring in food from other places. So it's a very different paradigm to what we're used to in the sense of come in, give us your money and get out and go on your way here domestically. So, you know, you take sort of all these different pieces and you put together a system that, again, really is operating in the gray area. But, you know, these clubs will say to you, I'm a taxpayer. Of course, I'm a legal business. And, you know, how many times did, you know, we hear that in California, I pay taxes. You can't confiscate my product. You can't charge me to the federal, you know, I'm a taxpayer, right? And so, again, those parallels are there and the sort of missing protections are there. But, you know, I think from my experiences, I can't ever recall a conversation where, other than maybe during Spanibus, where there was like a bust or you know, real police activity, or you heard about, you know, a club or a cultivator being shut down or arrested. You know, I know some of our partners there have had situations where the government has come to them and said, we don't want you to produce vape pens a couple years ago. And they requested that they stopped and that was done. And now the government has actually come back and said, we prefer if you started putting vape pens back into process because we don't want people smoking on the street. If they vape, so be it. But you have a really, really interesting dichotomy, again, just between the local government, the sort of overseer in Madrid, and then the way these laws are set up with, again, this donation concept of to nonprofit social clubs like collectives were in California, but with a consume in the club only setup. So it's very interesting. And, you know, it really does remind me of 2015-16 in California, where, again, there were laws, but did they really matter? And depending on who you asked or which cop you ran into or which politician. And certainly, you know, there was a lot of money being made and certainly being sophisticated money being made around brands. But still this sort of self-rule, if you will. And I think Barcelona in general is sort of, you know, has that paradigm of, again, you know, you couldn't speak the Catalonian language there 15 years ago on the street legally. So they have a huge identity, I don't know, power need, if you will. The people there really want to hold on to their identity. And I think that translates to the cannabis market. The people you see working in those places are, they think that's the most blessed moment of their life to make 6-7 euro an hour to help you get your cannabis. So it's a really different but similar situation as it has been here in the past domestically.
Well, RJ, there's so much to unpack in all of that. And I want to harken back to something you said at the very beginning of our conversation, which was this issue of culture. When you're dealing with globalization and global ability of cannabis and taking cannabis companies around the world, you're dealing with different cultures. And you're touching on this very, very interesting point, which is that every culture is different. It has nuances. And I'm really glad you brought up Spanibus, because I know you were going to attend. Bob, you were going to attend.
Yep.
This is the biggest cannabis event in Europe. It's been running for almost 2 decades at this point. And I don't know if you would just kind of tell us, I know you were going to run a special event at Spanibus called Hotel California. Maybe you could give us a sense of why you chose that name, but also, you know, why is it so important to have these networking events, particularly with people from around the world convening in these places and getting people together?
Yeah. So, you know, we were actually fortunate enough to get Hotel California accomplished the day before Spanibus was canceled. So that was a dispensary partner event or a social club partner event that we were able to get done. And we actually maxed out the capacity at this club because so many people were, I think, disappointed that they couldn't go to Spanibus, but also because, as you said, it is the biggest event in Europe and it is a cultural thing. You know, our partner there took third place in one of the large, off-site competitions. And people were there just to take pictures with him of the trophy and to taste the award-winning products and things of that nature. And so when you talk about culture, both the culture of the folks hosting it and also the people and the camaraderie from all over the world that really resonates and gets built, the community that exists around Spanibus. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a place more lively than Barcelona, you know, that week before and week after of Spanibus. And, you know, the clubs are just alive with so many interesting conversations, so many great products, and just so many people, you know, being humble and open and really being excited to meet each other. And, you know, I think that's what Hotel California was always about for us. And the name was selected by our partners over there who really wanted to get that California, not only, you know, sort of, you can sit down with a group of folks from California and kind of learn from them, which is what it was, but also, you know, that business element of networking and making connections, which again is sort of a new thing for out there because it is so communal or tribal. You know, you have to know people to get ahead. But we were trying to bring some of that, you know, California entrepreneurship. How can we connect and do collective business together to that table and sort of start to progress the paradigm in a way that, you know, allows more people to get involved without losing its identity, which I think is something that I have big hopes for in Barcelona.
Well, you know, with Spanibus being on again, off again, off again, on again, you know, there was that whole PR, I wouldn't call it a nightmare, but you know, I just remembered that was supposed to start 3 weeks of European travel, business travel for me. And, you know, sitting there and had several friends that were there saying, no, everything's normal here. Everything's normal there. And, you know, again, I try to stay away from the news in this day and age, because it's just entirely misleading in so many different ways. But at the end of the day, we saw the numbers in Spain going up and up and up. And we knew that it was a place that was objectively hit with this early and often. Do you have any inside glimpse or insight into what was going on there in the organizers' minds and what caused it to go the way it went?
You know, I don't necessarily want to say that I know everything about everything, but we had a booth at Spanibus in 2019, and I've obviously, because of that, had a number of interactions with the team behind it. I've also worked with High Times in the past to bring the right judges into their newer events where they have less judging, and it's not, you know, really, again, in the community that used to be there, and was working with them to make sure that their event in Barcelona was going to come off right. And you know, it's sort of like being in the middle of a conversation. There's three sides. There's somebody else, you know, Spanibus sides, High Time sides, and the truth. And somewhere in the middle of both of their stories lies the reality. But what I can say is I think what happened was, you know, they didn't want to be they didn't want to cancel, right? They wanted to let the government cancel. And thereby, whether that was an insurance play, that was a, you can't blame us, that was a, you know, our partners want people to come into the city, even if this event doesn't happen, you know, the city is dependent on us to bring people in. I don't know what exactly motivated them to hold that long, but I genuinely believe they wanted to be free of, the responsibility for canceling. Now, again, whether that's because they wanted to collect insurance or they didn't want to refund booths or they really just were trying to put the event together regardless of what the rules were, I think you hit the nail on the head, Bob. A lot of people were watching the news, and that city was not nearly as packed as it had been in the last 3 or 4 years that I was there for the event. And, you know, when they ran Masters of Rosin Ceremony, which is another off-market or off-festival event, if you will, HQ Social Club, which is probably the biggest club out there. They ran that days early, you know, with an hour to make the award ceremony happen. And there was maybe 50 people there, and 40 of them were the contestants. And me and another friend were two of the 10 people that weren't contestants. And usually that's like the hottest ticket. It's impossible to get into. You know, you have to basically buy your way in from either $1,000 judges kit or a sponsorship, and there was nobody there. So, you know, I don't know if they were, again, trying to cover their own asses or they were trying to bring people into the city. But either way, it was kind of unfortunate the way it all turned out for a lot of people, including myself, because, yeah, I had another 6 weeks of travel planned after that, Germany, Israel, you know, all over the place. And it obviously didn't come to happen.
No, it didn't. But hopefully things will pick up sometime soon. But maybe that's a good place to sort of round things out. How do you envision networking in this day and age? Do you think things are going to get back to quote unquote normal? You know, let's face it. Human beings have a short memory. That's an absolute fact. Yeah. The two or three or 4 months of being waylaid or shut down or quarantined, the minute things get back to normal, people are going to start behaving and acting like normal, and this will be just a blip on the screen. We hope. Of course, that's based on what we know right now, which isn't exactly the most informed scenario given political leadership around the world. But what are the next steps for events, large gatherings, networking?
Yeah, you know, I think the major takeaway from COVID and obviously also the George Floyd or Black Lives Matter movement, I think a lot of businesses throughout the supply chain and sorry, what have you have come to look at the concept of ROI or return on investment in a lot stronger of a light than they ever had. I think you're going to see a lot of people questioning whether they were really getting the return on the large events that they thought they were. And I think that's going to be super dependent on how these virtual events go. I know MJ's got one going on. I know Hall of Flowers is doing one. I just got an email from Scentsy that's doing one. So, you know, there's a push to virtual events. And, you know, to be blunt, with Outspoke, which is our supply chain management platform, we were looking at facilitating virtual meetings and selling experiences back in Q3 of 2019. And people were like, nobody's going to attend that. You know, that's way too far in advance. You know, it's the same concept as a Dutch auction. You're way too ahead, blah, blah, blah. And now, you know, everybody and their brother and sisters hosting webinars or virtual networking events, right? So I think there'll be a balance that goes on there. I think you'll see more impactful experiences at events, whether that is because there's smaller attendance or because, again, there's more of a question of is there ROI around this or is it worth it? I think you'll see an improvement to events because of it. It's really just a matter of when you're going to be able to get 30,000 people back in the Las Vegas Convention Center, whether that's going to be this year or next year, or if this is going to continue to be a cycle of you know, sort of COVID-related situations that continue to, you know, sort of
force
virtual networking.
Yeah. Well, and it does just seem on that topic of global ability, and Bob, I think you would agree with this, that being in a room with other people who are from around the world and getting to share experiences and talk about this industry, it is a valuable thing and it is hard to replicate in the virtual sphere, but that's just where we are right now. And, you know, this has been an absolutely wonderful conversation, and I'm hoping you would even consider being our Spain correspondent here on the Hoban Minute, RJ, just with how knowledgeable you are and on top of everything that's going on over there. But we couldn't be happier to have you on, and thank you for sharing your experience and perspective.
Well, and I would just say, as things continue to evolve, please think of us as well. We're definitely following what you're doing, and we hope to have you again on the podcast sometime soon.
Totally. Well, I really appreciate y'all having me, and you know, being a big fan of the work that Bob you've led and the team behind you, and for a very long time. So, be honored to have had this conversation, and yes, would love to be your boots on the ground Spain voice for Hoban anytime.
Well, much appreciated. Thank you again for joining us. Until next time, yep. Eric. That's been the Hoban Minute.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. If you have any ideas for episode topics or guests, we would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.